Hello, everybody. This is Stu Smith, and I'm here with special guest Chad Williams. He is a former SEAL, and he has a great story to tell. And so this is part of my series, the To, Through, and After series, if you're not familiar with it. Basically, what we do is we talk about Chad, who he was, and his journey throughout, you know, his beginning of his life to going through BUDS and graduating BUDS and going into the teams and what he's doing now. And this one's a great little journey. I think you'll get some great nuggets on, you know, helping you along with your journey if you have a similar goal. Because I tell everybody this, Chad, and everybody will agree whenever they hear it, is that, you know, every spec ops guy, every champion, every professional athlete was a wannabe dreamer at one point.
That's right.
You know, yeah. We all have dreams.
So, yeah, in fact, you know, for me, I'll probably just jump in kind of coming right out of high school. That's sort of the timing where you got to figure out, you know, what is it that you want to do? You know, what is your dream? I had a little bit of a background in skateboarding. I was sponsored by Vans Shoes for a while, competing, nice. Doing that. But I kind of realized, like, this isn't my destiny. Like, this isn't my forever future here. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. You know, at this point, I had two passions, skateboarding, fishing, and then, you know, baseball was something in the background that I used to think, like, maybe I'll be a pro ball player, but I grew out of that. So I didn't have any plans in terms of, you know, education. So I find myself just kind of going with the flow, attending a local community college, and not really passing any of my classes. And that was just because I wasn't showing up. You know, I was ditching, hanging out with friends, partying, going surfing. But now it's the end of that first year, and it's time to take those big tests, you know, finals. And I didn't prepare for them at all. And I remember pulling into that parking lot. The parking lot was all wet. It had been raining the night before. I'm sitting in this spot about to go take these tests. I don't stand a chance of making it through. And that's when it just really hit me. It sunk in. Like, I am turning out to be a loser, the kind of guy that, you know, no young person wants to be, you know, because when you're young, you get told, like, hey, the sky's the limit. You could do anything you want to do with your life. That big word potential gets thrown around. And that's all very true. But there does come a certain point in life where it's time to fish or cut bait. Like, the question is, like, what trajectory are you on? And so I'm not on a good one. I'm not even average Joe. I mean, all of my peers are passing me by. So I'm just thinking, how can I turn this around? So I'm brainstorming hard. And, you know, there's a saying, the greater the need, the greater the result. And so I felt like I was in a very desperate situation. And so I think that's sort of where the creativeness started to kind of come out and capture the vision. I'm thinking, I want to do something big with my life. I know I want to do something great. So as I'm sitting there in my truck in this parking lot, I think I come up with the perfect plan. My first thought was, I know I'm going to do with my life. I'm going to go become an Alaskan crab fisherman, because I'm thinking deadliest catch. It's by far one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. It's something that I was attracted to. And I almost settled on that when this other idea entered my mind. And that was, you know, why can't I go join the military? But not just that. I want to be a part of the most elite. I want to go through that most difficult, grueling military training. I know what I want to be. I want to be a U.S. Navy SEAL. And so right there in that parking lot, as I'm about to go to class and take these tests, I don't stand a chance of passing. I just make up my mind. This is what I'm going to do with my life. I'm going to be a Navy SEAL. So then I thought, well, if I'm going to be a frogman, my first order of business is this. I don't need to go to class anymore. And so I just started my truck up and took off out of that parking lot. And I went to a schoolyard and I started doing pull-ups and dips and push-ups right away. I was kind of assessing the situation, like, where am I at here?
Now, how old were you at this point?
I was 18 years old. Yeah, turning 19. And so after a while, I know that I got to let my dad know some bad news and good news, as I put it. You know, I got to let him know what was going on at school, you know, that I'm not passing any of these classes. And so the way that I framed it was, I got some bad news and good news. So I share with him the bad news. And he's like, okay, son, what's the good news? I'm like, it's all right, Dad. I got a plan. I'm going to be a Navy SEAL. And so you can kind of put yourself in his shoes for a moment there. He's kind of, you know, walking me back through the track record of my life and just reminding me, like, son, you know, joining the military is nothing like nothing you've ever done in the past, like playing ball or skateboarding or going to a local community college, that when you decide you're over it and you just want to stop, that you could just, that's it. He says, if you join the military, maybe then you find out it's not for you. Or suppose you quit, you don't make it through SEAL training. Just so you know, there's no getting out. You're still going to be in the military. And you're probably going to get a job like chipping paint off some boat in Japan. And so for whatever reason, like that was the best motivational speech right there. Like I needed that. I'm like, that is not going to be me. Yeah. And so I know that actions speak louder than words. And so I just decided, you know, I'm going to prove it. I'm going to show them. And so I'm doing all the preparation, you know, all the running, swimming, and kind of putting together my own programming. And, you know, at that time, this is back in like 2003, there wasn't a whole lot of information out there. I wasn't good at finding information either. You know, you don't have the prolification of information that we have today, yeah, you know, on the internet. And so I was just kind of doing my own thing, stumbling along. And I remember my dad inviting me into the house one day as I'm running by, he calls me in and he says, okay, so you really want to do this, huh? You want to be a SEAL? I'm like, yeah, Dad, I want to be a SEAL. He goes, great. I set up a workout for you with the Navy SEAL. Check out my computer screen. I'll never forget standing there and I'm thinking, my dad doesn't know any Navy SEALs. Like, what is this? And there's this little one-liner in an email he wants me to look at. And it just says, can Chad come out and play tomorrow? And so I'm like, play? Like, Dad, you set up an arrangement for me and some guy off the internet that says he wants to play with me. And you're putting this together right now. He goes, well, yeah. I'm like, Dad, you can't trust everything somebody tells you, like, on the internet. Like, this guy could be, like, whatever. And he goes, no, this guy's a Navy SEAL, Chad. I'm like, all right, I'll go meet up with the guy. And so what I didn't know about at the time was there's actually a phone conversation that taken place prior to that email with this, as far as I'm concerned, a Navy SEAL. And this is how it went. I didn't know how it went before, but I got the backstory later, but it's better to have it up front for anyone listening.
Yeah.
And so my dad's on the phone with this Navy SEAL, Scott Helvenston. And he's telling Scott, he says, hey, you know, he's first of all stoked to get him on the phone. He says, look, my son wants to be a Navy SEAL, but here's the deal. He has no idea what he's signing up for. He doesn't know what he's getting himself involved in. And so he was asking him for a big favor, if he'd be willing to meet up with me. But what he was asking him to do is he says, I want you to crush him. Just bury him. Beat this desire of becoming a SEAL out of him, you know, if you could do that. And so Scott kind of thought about it for a while. And his reply back when he decided he'd do it was in that email. Can Chad come out and play tomorrow? So I have no idea what I'm getting myself involved in. All I know is I'm meeting up with this Navy SEAL in a beach parking lot in Oceanside, California. And I mean, I spotted him right away because he was quite the physical specimen. I'm like, that's the guy right there. And he spots.
And real quick, I don't mean to interrupt, but I just have to say, if for those of you who aren't familiar with who Scott Helvenston is, you have to look into some of his history, because he is by far one of the toughest, most in shape guys I have ever seen, but by far.
For instance, yeah, you know, to that point, he was on a TV program called Man vs. Beast, where they set up an obstacle course and trained a chimpanzee to run through it at superhuman speed. Who's going to beat a monkey going through an obstacle course? But Scott, you know, he's pulling ahead of that monkey on the monkey bars. He's the only man to beat the beast on that program.
Yeah, they call him Scott Helveston bars now.
That's right. So he's a phenomenal athlete. He's the youngest guy to make it through SEAL training. He completed SEAL training by the age of 17 years old.
Yes.
World champion pentathlete. I know that he had the record on the obstacle course over at Bud's, you know, for a while.
Yeah.
So I don't know all this about him, you know, when I'm meeting him in this parking lot. He just spots me, points a finger at me, says, you Chad? Like, yes, sir. And I was Bubba from that point forward. All right, Bubba, come on over here. And so he had another guy there that was a Marine, but he was going to be re-enlisting into the Navy. He wanted to be a SEAL. And so this is like my first exposure, you know, to any military. It's these two guys, you know, this Navy SEAL and this Marine. And so he's got this pull-up bar hanging from the bathrooms, and I'm doing pull-ups with them and push-ups, these different calisthenics. And I'm thinking, all right, I'm hitting all the numbers. Like, maybe I got this. And so Scott ends up sending myself and this Marine off on a run. And he tells the Marine, this guy, Seth, he says, Seth, why don't you lead the way for the first 15 minutes, you know, out into the wetlands there. And then after 15 minutes, Bubba, why don't you go ahead and take over, and you go as fast as you want to go. And so, you know, we take off. And Seth is one of these big, muscular, brute force kind of guys, which is great for plowing a door down, taking somebody down. But when it comes to running, you know, he didn't really have the frame. And at the right. time, I was a real wiry, like 145-pound guy. I was ready to just take
off.
And there was something about, you know, that age, you know, where I'm like 18, 19, this sort of, you know, maybe arrogance and just like wanting to push things. And so I decide I'm going to burn like this guy. I'm taking off on him. So I'm leaving him in the dust and feeling very proud about it. And I'm looking over my shoulder. I don't see the Marine anymore. And I don't even know what the final destination is. I was just told, go down this dirt trail away from the ocean, you know, away from civilization. I'm not seeing people around. I'm looking back. I'm thinking, where's that Marine? Where's that Navy SEAL? And when I think like, man, they're not even going to catch up. I'm thinking of the names of my friends and be bragging to at the Marine and Navy SEAL couldn't catch me on this run. Well, I look back again, and it is like a scene out of Terminator 2. Like Arnold Schwarzenegger, where that bad guy, the T-1000
oh, yeah.
uniform, can like yep. morph into these knife hands and chase down the moving vehicle. I look back, and that's Scott Helvenston coming down this trail, like knife hands for me. Mm-hmm. And there is nothing I could do to keep that distance. I mean, I'm running so fast. A lot of your listeners probably kind of know this feeling where you don't even have time to spit at the wrong moment because it can completely throw off your breathing rhythm. Yeah. That's the clip that we're moving at. He closes that distance, catches right up to where I am. We're side by side on the trail. He gets just past me, and he just plants down, pivots, turns, and I was greeted by his fist just impaling my stomach. I mean, I got clotheslined. Feet right off the ground, back into the ground, poof of dirt up all around me. And you got to put yourself in my shoes for a moment here because you got to remember that at the time, all I'm thinking is this. Some guy my dad met off the internet. Now he's got me on the ground in the wetlands. I'm thinking child predator. Like, this is happening right now. And so I'm trying to like fight and resist. He's jumping on top of me. He's got like the neon belly. He's screaming in my face, spit flying out. I remember just that feeling of it hitting me in the cheek, the forehead. And I don't even understand the words he's saying. But then this comes through. He says, you want to be a Navy SEAL? You better stay 3 paces behind me. He gets up, turns, begins to take off. I just had the wind knocked out of me after running as fast as I could. I'm still doing the weird, like, growling, like, oh. And he turns and says it again, 3 paces, and he takes off. And so I'm going after him. And this went on and on down this trail. He's smashing me down, getting back up, going after him, and I'm staying on his heels. But I'll tell you what, looking back in hindsight, after having gone, you know, through training, I'll say this. I never went through a more difficult singular workout, or I should call it a beatdown session, then this encounter, you know, with Scott Helvenston. And so finally he gets to a point where he circles up and he's pacing back and forth. I don't know what is on his mind, but he's looking at me like he wants to fight me. And I'm thinking in my mind, like, man, I don't want to fight this Navy SEAL. Like, I'm just this like teenage skater punk kid. So I'm kind of having this self-dialogue, like, okay, no direct eye contact with this guy. Like, just, you know, do you don't want to set this guy off? Use your peripherals. Don't look him in the eyes. And, he breaks this very awkward tension by asking me, says, hey, if we would have gone another mile or two, would you have stayed with me? I just told him, I said, Scott, I'll die before I quit. And he totally loosens up. I mean, he loved that. He changes yeah. demeanor. He goes, great. Hey, you want to meet up again for another workout tomorrow? I'm kind of thinking like, what just happened? Like, are we going to address the flashback you just had on that trail? Like, you assaulted me, dude. But of course, I wasn't going to say that. I just was like, okay. And so I'm going back, kind of dragging my feet, like, what just happened there? But then I got excited, like, hey, I made it. You know, if this is what it takes, like, I'll do it again. I'll do it again tomorrow. I'll do it again the next day. So I kind of go from this attitude of dragging my feet out of there to I'm clicking my heels. I'm excited. And I got home and my dad's like, hey, how did it go? And I just come through that door. I'm like, Dad, I'm going to do it. I'm going to be a SEAL. And I remember like the look of shock, you know, on his face, like, wow. And so I got to start meeting up with Scott from that point forward. And thankfully, it was no longer a beatdown session. It became more of a building up. And I moved on in life from just being Bubba to eventually he began to call me Junior. You know, he really took me under his wing. He was like nice. a second father to me. Nice. And so he got me really prepared. And I want to tell you another thing that really got me prepared was a guide called Navy SEAL Fitness by a man named Hugh Smith. And I still have that guide to this day. And I followed your programming in there. And yeah, just fast forward 2 months, I remember being in first phase on the grinder. And I was thinking about all the other information that I'd found on the internet, like this is how you should prepare. And I tried out some of these different things. Then, you know, I got to spend time with Scott and I went through your guide. I did the programming in there. When I was on the grinder at Buds, I thought all the other stuff that I read about, that information was complete junk. Like it did not apply, not helpful. But Stu Smith and that guide like is totally legit. I thought like some of your programming is very much like some of the evolutions that you do on the grinder there. So I remember like in my mind where I was at on the grinder thinking, I wish I spent more time like doing the programming that was in, you know, your
thank
book.
You. So, thank you very much.
That's you there. Like legit. I always recommend it. And so, you know, Scott and your programming, I felt like I was ready. And so I sign up and I've got a date. It's set. I'm going to be shipping off, you know, to boot camp. And Scott winds up taking an opportunity, as he put it, to go overseas again. And I remember he's telling me, you know, who knows, Junior, you know, perhaps it could make, you know, a difference. I didn't really understand what he was going to be doing over there at the time. You know, I didn't really get it. I knew he was going to be doing some private contracting. He was saying that he was going to be with some guys that, you know, were maybe some former SEALs or former special forces from different branches of the military. But he was telling me it's only going to be a couple months long. And so it's crazy because right now I'm not at my house. I'm at my parents' house. I got kids and they would be, you know, super loud in the background, but I'm actually just, I mean, it just hit me right now. I'm like 3 feet away from the phone conversation that I had with him as he was about to go. He was going to leave before I left for boot camp. It was a very fast turnaround. And so he gets on the phone with me and he says, all right, Junior, I'm about to go do this thing, referring to going off to Iraq. And he says, I just want you to know something though. That I've never told anybody that I've ever trained before. And so I know these next words are going to be very important. So I'm like, send it. And he says, I know you're going to make it through SEAL training. And to hear like that type of vote of confidence from somebody that I looked up to,
that's powerful.
Like, so much. I can't even put it into words. Like it meant the world to me. And I felt like this sort of burden and excitement and expectancy. Like I can't wait to prove him right. Like to make him proud. And so he's just reminding me of the timeline that he's only going to be gone a couple months. That's about as long as I'll be over there at Great Lakes. And by the time I finally get my shot at Buds in San Diego, you know, he's going to be there. And he says, we're going to see you make it through. So we get off the phone. You know, we say our goodbyes. Can't wait to see you when you get back, Scott. You know, so now he's gone. I just got a handful of days left before I take off. And so I figure if I can't work out with my mentor in person, the next best thing is just do some of the programming that I've got, you know, from your book and some of the exercises I remembered. And I'm getting up one day and the television's on, which is just a few feet away from me. And I see Scott on the TV. And so my first thought, Scott's been on TV a lot. He's a phenomenal athlete, always getting invited on. And it's a picture of him smiling. So I just thought, what is Scott doing on TV? He didn't let me know he's going to be on TV again for something. And I'm thinking he's supposed to be overseas right now. So it's a typical profile shot they use before they introduce somebody onto a program, smiling image. And then I see in the lower third of the screen, though, Scott's birth date followed by a dash. And it says March 31st, 2004. And before I could even process in my mind, like what that means right there, like draw a conclusion, I didn't have a chance because it cuts from the smiling picture to just graphic video footage. It's first a vehicle that's burning in the background, and this is the vehicle that Scott was in. And then it cuts to these scenes where, you know, it's him and these three other guys that he was with. The vehicle they were in was ambushed, and now they're lifeless in the streets of Fallujah, Iraq, and all these different scenes of angry Iraqi mobs with sticks and rods beating and trying to mutilate their bodies. And you know, they find rope then and hook it around their legs, and they go dragging them through the streets of Fallujah. They get to the Euphrates River Bridge, string them upside down, set their bodies on fire. And then I'll never forget the message that they had for us in America. They began to chant over and over into the camera in Arabic, Fallujah is the graveyard of Americans. Fallujah is the graveyard of Americans. And I think pretty needless to say, I'll never have the words to describe just what all the surrounding moments were like. You know, I totally went through all the emotions. I mean, to the point where I even began to maybe with my mind play around like, hey, maybe Scott's he's got some – I didn't know how the SEALs were at the time. I wasn't in yet. You know, maybe he's got some secret operation, and they had to fake a death because there's no way like this would happen to him. And so he's got something, you know, super covert that he has to do. you know, but at the same time, I was looking at the TV and I idolized Scott. You know, yeah. I remember sitting next to him in the car. He's his arms up there on the wheel. I'm looking at his forearms thinking, man, I want my arms to be like Scott's one day, like taking mental pictures. And it's like, I know those arms, you know, I know who I saw. And so, you know, this definitely changed me as a human being. It was a big wake up call. Yeah. You know, I used to think of being a Navy SEAL sort of like the Charlie Sheen, you know, rock star, you know, invincible. And then this happens. And so all those emotions going through, and I definitely had anger and hatred. I wanted to jump through that TV screen right there at that moment without any training and just rip the hearts out of these guys and take their throats out.
Yeah.
And so I had to come up with, you know, eventually it was put to me, like my family, they're, you know, they got to know Scott. So now they're begging me, because this is reality. Like, we don't want this to happen to you. They're begging me, don't go, like, don't do this. You know, but as I thought about it, it's like, no, I got to do this. And I want to do it for so much more now. You know, it started off as, I just want to do something big, something great. You know, but now it's like, I want to do this in honor and memory of my mentor. And I'm not going to lie, at the time, I wanted revenge. I wanted that opportunity, you know, to get some revenge. And so I was just days away from going. I ended up going through, you know, Navy boot camp at Great Lakes. And then I, you know, went through an A school. I was a OS, which I don't really remember a whole lot about that, because it was basically 7 or 8 weeks of my life of training for something that
they have such a better system now, don't they?
Yeah.
With the whole like, SO system and
that opportunity to go straight from Great Lakes to Buds. Oh man. Yeah. Cause it's a waste. Yeah. I guess like back then the thinking was that the majority of these guys that show up for Buds, they're not going to make it. Mm-mm. And so they need a job to do, you know, once they're in. I don't even know what do they do with a guy now that doesn't make it? Do they go undesignated?
They can get designated and go to do something, but yeah, it's tough. You know, it's a tough journey, you know?
I was just biting my fingernails, waiting for that opportunity to finally get over there to Buds. And I actually ended up getting over there a little early for my class. And so I was one of those white shirts that's like running around and, you know, it's kind of helping out, you know, whatever the instructors want you to do for the classes. And I was like one, a handful of guys for my class. We ended up classing up with about 173 guys, but we were like the first 5 or 6 guys to show up. So we had a lot of waiting to do. So they asked us, hey, do you want to go out to the island, San Clemente Island, and help out, you know, with third phase out there? So that was really cool to get an inside look of like, hey, these are some of the guys that have pretty much made it, you know, and we're picking up brass on, you know, the firing line for these guys. And, you know, eventually enough guys showed up, you know, to class up. So I was part of Bud's class 254. And, you know, most people are pretty familiar with a lot of the stories. I think a word of advice, you know, for guys that are getting ready, and this is something we kind of talked about a little bit. I didn't know about this before, is that before you go into Hell Week, like that night, these instructors, they allow you to write on the inside of your hat. And they want you to write some things on the inside of your hat that are going to get you to dig deep, you know, when the going gets tough. And so as I was thinking about, like, what am I going to put on the inside of my hat? I knew one of the first things right away, Scott. So I put his name big on my hat, Scott Halpinston. And I was thinking, well, some of the other things I want to put on the inside of my hat, you know, family, you know, my family, this is important. This is one thing I think that everyone should take. My family will never get that phone call from me in the middle of the week when they should not be hearing from me saying, hey, I quit. I'd rather die than have that conversation. And so that's the mentality we got to have. You always hear, you know, that mentality of being willing to die before you quit. Guess what? They're not going to kill you. They're not going to kill you at Bud. So if you're willing to die before you quit, they're not going to kill you. You won't die. You're not going to quit. You won't be ringing that bell. But you got to have that why figured out, right?
Yes.
Because we
long before
we live in a generation now where it's so popular, it's sort of narcissistic. It's the selfie generation where when you ask people sometimes like, hey, why do you want to do this thing that you want to do? And I think that I started off this way, maybe in that junior college.
I think I did too.
It was a me thing. I want to do something great with my life.
Yep.
You know? And so
I want to prove it to myself. I want to prove, you know, it was like something to prove, you know, to, exactly.
Yep. But that won't be enough when the going gets tough, because we only go so far for ourselves. But how far will you go for your own family? You go to the wheels fall off.
Right.
You know, in fact, you know, sometimes women will come up to like a book table after speaking somewhere, you know, and they'll say, oh, you know, I could never do that. I could never make it through SEAL training. And, you know, I kind of joke around, like, have you ever seen G.I. Jane? But, you know, as I think about it, it's like, well, what if your children were on the firing line and they said, woman, if you don't make it, you know, to Friday evening, we're going to execute your children. All of a sudden you see Mama Bear come out. Oh yeah, I would make it through. Yeah. You know, you see that change. And so it's that why. So you got to have that why figured out. So you only go so far for yourself. You go to the wheels fall off, you know, for the sake of your own family. I'm doing this in honor and memory of my mentor. You know, I had a faith-based background during that time. So I'm like, well, I'm going to need God's help. So I had a scripture on the inside of my hat. And so it's like there's three categories there, faith, family, and friends. I had those on the inside of my hat. And man, when it got tough, you know, during surf tortures or during, you know, boats, I would look up. And those are the things that really got me to dig deep and just have that mentality. You know, I'll die before I quit. And so, yeah, Hell Week, you know, we all have, you know, funny hallucination stories. I remember the last night of Hell Week during Around the World, that paddle.
Yeah, you know, that's when I hallucinated so much too. Yeah.
What's that?
That's when I hallucinated and saw all kinds of craziness.
Because you're at your most tired, weakest, vulnerable, you know, moment. And the weirdest stuff happens out in the water. There's just something about the sea. Yeah. Like that's where you see things that really aren't there. So growing up watching Ninja Turtles, you know, I'm paddling along and all of a sudden there's Donatello like coming up out of the water looking at me. And I mean, he seems so real that I got to try and touch him with the paddle. So I'm trying to whack him. And like another one, Leonardo coming up out of the water. I'm trying to whack him with my paddle. And I remember one of the guys, usually when you're having a hallucination, you know, one of the other guys at least has his wits about him. Right. So, you know, he's like, Williams, what are you doing? And I'm like, dude, I see Ninja Turtles. Well, this guy, instead of saying like, hey, dummy, you gotta keep paddling, he's like, where? He's trying to find him, looking for him. And of course, he's not going to see, you know, this projection of my own mind.
Sure.
But looking back on it, you know, it's one of those funny things. But, you know, when you're going through it, it's pretty crazy on the mind.
It really is. In fact, I've always tried to explain it as like, it is your dreams superimposed over reality.
Interesting.
Right? So you're basically sleeping with your eyes open and you're seeing what your brain is projecting, like you said. And I remember seeing, you know, all the old cartoon characters, right? Bugs Bunny, Duck, all those guys. But they were on the top of these bridge pylons like Pez dispensers. Right? And I'd just be looking up. I'd stop paddling and just look up at the Pez dispensers like, wow, that's crazy. You know, I think it was all those big, you know, those ship cranes in the bay. They had those big ship cranes there, and I thought those were gigantic horses. I mean, it was just crazy. And then one of my buddies next to me kept pushing like this, you know, kept pushing against something. I'm like, what are you doing? He wasn't paddling. He was just, I don't want to hit this wall. I'm just pushing this wall. And I'm like,
yeah, this wall. Man,
there's no wall there.
I love it.
Yeah, it's just.
Was it a class tradition when you're going through for the class that was ahead of you, the brown shirts, to try and swim out some contrabands?
Yeah, that was always really cool. Yeah, that was.
Yeah, I remember as the class ahead of us was doing that, and they're going to swim out. You know, they had these white powdered donuts, they had Gatorades and Snickers bars, and it's this cat and mouse game. The instructors are looking for them. They want to try and bust them in the process of this.
Yep.
And I remember seeing the guys running along the shoreline in the bay, and they're about to make their way out onto this bridge where they're going to throw the stuff to us. But in my mind, those weren't brown shirts. I thought they were ninjas. So I was all about Ninja Turtles at the time. So I thought they were ninjas. And I see the lighting of, like, houses and buildings in the background. And for whatever reason, like, these buildings that were maybe only a couple few stories, it just grew to like a skyscraper in my mind, like way up. And it was a giant dojo that they're just pouring out of. And I'm telling the guys, as we see these brown shirts, in my mind, ninjas, I'm telling them, the ninjas are coming to get us. The ninjas are coming to get us. And I'm getting them all worked up. They're like, huh? You know, it's like just that whole like suggestion in their mind. Like, what is this? And we see these silhouettes coming along, and they're trying to swim out to the water. And so I've got these guys so convinced that we're being attacked by some, you know, foreign group right now, that we are trying to smack these guys with the paddles. Like, they're bringing a big hefty bag of food for us, and we're just trying to beat on them and wail away. And I remember one of them threw a bag into the boat, you know, from a bridge that was up, lands in the boat, and we're all just kind of like, oh. And we start to open it up, and that's where we find. And we're in first place at this point. It pays to be a winner.
Oh, absolutely.
We're way out ahead. We're the Smurf crew. You know, we're doing our thing. And now we've got this bag of, like, white powdered donuts, Gatorade, Snickers. We just stop paddling and start floating along. And we're just – everyone's passing us up, you know, going by. We end up coming in last place. And we don't want to give up the bag as we're about to hit a checkpoint. And so we decide, let's tie it off, dump it over the side, and you know, we'll grab it on the way back out. So we dump, we tie it, leave it to the side. We go paddle the rest of the way in. It's a very lit up area now where we're paddling in, and the instructors are beating us for, you know, not being first. And eventually it's about time to go back out. But, you know, we're standing there, you know, at the ready, ready to go. And the instructor, he knows, you know, we got some food at some point. And he's looking around the boat. He's trying to find it. And he comes up to me. And he asked me, because we're looking around at each other. And suddenly we realize, like, our faces are covered in white powdered donut. Like, just all over. There's no denying it, right? And this instructor Simons, he goes, Mr. Williams, you know anything about any contraband on the boat? I'm like, no, Instructor Simons. And he, like, takes his finger, puts it on my face, wipes it. It's got all that white powdered donut. And he goes, what is this? And I don't know why, but I had, like, a moment where I'm just like, this is maybe a good, like, I go, maybe it's dried sea salt, Instructor Simons. And he just laughed at that. You know, he knew what it was. And at that time, that bag that we had dumped in the water, it's literally coming bobbing in. Like, we all see it. It's on his heels. He's at the edge of the water, and the bag is right there. And all he had to do was turn around, he would have found it. But he never saw it. He liked what I said. He laughed at it, cut us loose. We ended up grabbing that bag, throw it back in the boat, and we had it for the rest of the journey. And so those are just a couple of unique stories there during Hell Week. All kinds of funny stories.
Yeah, there's a lot of fun that's had at Bud's. You know, it's not just constant beat downs. I mean, that's tough, and you're going to get uncomfortable, and you'll be in pain. But, it, you know, for the most part, the people you go through there, I mean, they just become your pals. And, you know, and you know, one thing's for sure. I mean, you're kind of forming your reputation, you know, during that week.
That's right.
You know? And it stays with you, you know, and it's, you know, it pays to be a winner, pays to put out, and pays to be a team player and all that. And you learn through all that. I think one thing you find that at the end of that thing, that your body is 10 times stronger than your mind will let it be.
Oh yeah.
You know,
you're certainly pretty beat up when you come out of Hell Week. You might be a guy that could knock out 20 dead hang pull-ups, but by the end of that week, the next day, good luck even being able to hang onto that bar, you know, for a while.
Yeah, you're beat up. So let's fast forward a little bit. So you made it through Bud's, and where did you go to your first team?
So my first team I got was a West Coast team, which I really wanted because I live out here on West Coast.
Yeah.
I'm just 2 hours away, you know, from where SEAL training goes down. I'm in Huntington Beach, California. So I got SEAL Team 1 and ended up deploying out to the Philippines. Was my first deployment. I thought, Philippines, like, what's going on in the Philippines? You know, you never hear about the Philippines in the news. Right. And I remember getting out there. It's very beautiful. It's like a paradise.
Yeah.
And I was one of the first guys to show up. And so I hadn't linked up yet. I flew privately to get out there. And my chief at the time, or was an LPO, I was telling him, like, wow, you know, so here we are, like, in paradise. I really wanted to be out in Iraq. I still had, you know, in a way, I had revenge, you know, on my mind.
Of course.
I was really bummed that I didn't get to go, you know, to the Middle East, you know, just the Philippines. It's like, well, you know, if we're out here, I guess we're going to have a pretty good time out here. You know, I had my fins and snorkel and mask. And I was diving and, you know, going after fish. And my LPO, he goes, yeah, beautiful place. And he's like, well, you know, you see that triple canopy, you know, jungle out there? I was like, yeah. He goes, you know, oh, it's pretty beautiful out here. There's some things going on out there that, you know, you do not see. And then right behind me, there's this hut. He said, like, see that hut right there? I was like, yeah. He goes, there's decapitated Filipino Marines inside of that hut right there. They were just ambushed on the road, you know, that we're going down. And they dismembered them. They took their cell phones that they had on them, and they had text messaged the wives of these men and sent pictures to them of their own husbands from their own phones of what they had done to them. So it's a beautiful place, but there's some serious evil out here. And, you know, at the time, you know, I was just learning about it. So this group, the Abu Sayyaf, and another group called the MILF, which is the Moral Islamic Liberation Front, and just a lot of the horrible things that they're doing, really just spreading through the Philippines by force. Basically, you know, they're saying, look, we're either going to kill you, you know, or you're a nobody, you know, you're just a fisherman or whatever that is. Like, we'll kill you or convert. And, you know, we'll give you more power and authority than you've ever had in all of your life. And so what we were doing there at the time was just an advise and assist type of operation with the Filipino Navy SEALs that were out there. They kind of have their own version of SEAL training. And so we kind of worked with those guys and, you know, we did what we could. It was one of those situations where, you know, it wasn't really our fight. You know, we could train these guys, kind of lead them up to the spot. We can help out, you know, with their wounded, their situations where, you know, we got their wounded out of, you know, some pretty gnarly situations. But yeah, that was the first deployment out to the Philippines. And so a lot of people don't realize, and it's still going on, you know, to this day. If you Googled it, you'd find some information on it. It would be covered. It's a real nasty group out there. Now, you know, the Abu Sayyaf and MILF, I think they're being inspired by ISIS, and everything's kind of transforming and converting over to them. And then I ended up getting a deployment, though, out to Iraq. And some things had happened between, you know, buds and that time, you know, getting to go to Iraq. You know, after I became a SEAL, I kind of had this sense that, you know, once I get that trident, you know, once that graduation date comes, there'll be some sort of closure. You know, I would have, you know, done this and walked in my mentor's footsteps. I would have achieved becoming, you know, a Navy SEAL. And for me, I felt like that's where the start of life was going to be. Like, that's the foothold. That's where everything finally comes together. I felt like everything was just so out of orbit and unsettled, like the world was pulled out from underneath me when everything happened with Scott. But once I become a SEAL, that's where everything will just coalesce, come together. And not only was it one of the happiest, most fulfilling moments of my life, you know, to make it, to get that trident, to have my family there, my friends, as they see, you know, you did it, you become a Navy SEAL. It's one of the happiest moments, but like, strangely, I couldn't understand it at the time. Like, shortly after that, it just became one of the lowest times in my life. And I felt like my life was just circling a drain and everything was going downhill from that point forward. But that's not something that I'm going to share with people, you know? And so we are all a certain person on the outside, you know, in front of our family members, our coworkers, our friends. When in reality, when you look around and you look around all your friends, the people that you know, there are some deep issues going on underneath it all. You know, it's represented in all those relationships, but a lot of us don't share it. And so at that time, I was just feeling just this void, and I couldn't make sense of it. And it was years later, I heard a philosopher by the name Ravi Zacharias. He hit the nail on the head. This is exactly what I experienced, and maybe a lot of the listeners are familiar with this to some degree. He says, one of the loneliest moments a man will ever experience is when he's achieved that which he thought would deliver the ultimate. And in the end, you know, that lets him down. And so what he's referring to is something I believe that everybody that's listening is familiar with, at least to some degree. It's that human condition. It's that whole idea that, you know, the grass is greener on the other side. Yeah. I'm not completely content or fulfilled with where I'm at. What I want is I just want a little bit more. And so what we do is we have these external goals or achievements, and we believe that if I had that over there, like, that's what would bring me fulfillment or satisfaction. And so that might be a certain level of education. It might be a profession. It might be a relationship. It might be, well, maybe we just need kids in our life, or, you know, maybe we need a bigger home. Maybe I need that car or that new Apple product over there. And so we're always going after these things. And you develop this hunger and this thirst. And so, like me, wanting to become a Navy SEAL, you know, I developed a hunger and a thirst. And that led to some good stuff. The good stuff it led to was this drive and this discipline that ultimately led to, I've achieved, I got there, I ate it up, and I was satisfied. But what happened was I found myself still hungry and thirsty, you know, for something more. But this was like the ultimate. So like in life, we set up all these sort of, I'd call them like lower level goals and achievements. You get there, you eat it up, you're satisfied, but the satisfaction doesn't last. So what do? You don't hit a panic switch. You just kind of step back for a moment. You put on your thinking cap. You start doing a little introspect, and a light goes off. Oh, I know why this isn't delivering, you know, the ultimate satisfaction. It's simple. I didn't go for something big enough.
Right. If I really What's next?
That lasting fulfillment, I got to raise the bar. I got to go for something bigger, something greater. So that's what we do in life. We raise the bar. We find that next goal. So we're thirsting after it. We put in all the hard work. We get there. We drink it up, and this is the one, baby. And what happens? The satisfaction doesn't last. And so it's almost like this vicious cycle in life. You get hungry and thirsty for more, and it just seemingly there is no end point. But that's the catch, and that's the whole point to this quote of this philosopher, is that there is an end point. See, the big question is, what happens when you finally arrive at a place where you no longer, like all the previous times before, can say, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll just go to the next rung of the ladder. You can't do that this time. Why? Because you found yourself pretty much at the last rung of the ladder. You know, you can't say, I'll go up the mountain a little bit higher from here, because you're at the peak of the mountain. And this isn't anything foreign. You see this in the lives of professional athletes, rock stars, movie stars, that have everything the world has to offer. You know, they have climbed to the top. And so this philosopher is saying, you know, one of the loneliest moments a man will ever experience, when he's achieved that which he thought would deliver the ultimate, in the end, that lets him down. You see these people that have it all. They've achieved the ultimate, and anyone would almost trade their skin to be in their shoes. Like, look at that guy over there. He's living a dream. You know, he could have anything that he wants. You know, any woman that guy wants, any house, any, you know, look at that guy's job. He gets to go to parts unknown. And what do we see going on inside their lives? These people that have it all, you know, the truth is underneath it all, they put this exterior on like everything's good to go. We never saw it coming. They're miserable, and they're destroying their own lives with drugs, alcohol, you know, committing suicide. And we're like, why? You had it all. And so, you know, maybe it's true, you know, that having it all in this world isn't really all that it's cracked up to be. And I think that the wisest man that ever walked the face of this planet, I think he framed it perfectly, this Jesus, when he says, what's it profit a man if he gains the whole world, but in the end loses his soul? And so coming out of Buds and making it into the teams, not knowing that that's what the issue was at the time, but realizing it soon, that my real issue here is that my soul is just not oriented correctly. I don't have a right relationship with my creator. And in my experience and my advice is, look, if you don't have any peace with the creator that made you, you're not really going to have any peace here on earth. And so that's how I felt. I felt just this unpeace about me. But I would later hear a message by a man by the name of Greg Laurie. And it was out of 2 Kings chapter 5 in the Bible, the story of a warrior. And so I'm thinking, great, at least if I'm going to hear, you know, a message like this, I get to listen to a message about a warrior. His name was Naaman. He's this commander. He had great success in battle, this entourage of men that highly respect him, highly regard him. Like, Naaman sounds like he could have been a Navy SEAL had there been such a thing during his time. This mighty man of valor, and then he just halts. But Naaman had leprosy. And so leprosy, looking back at that time, Jesus actually said nobody during the time of Naaman had ever been healed of leprosy. And so he's a dead man walking. So, like, picture this. Here he is, this mighty man of valor. He's got all the respect from everybody. You know, he's got this sort of exterior, when the truth is, underneath it all, what maybe not everybody sees is he's deteriorating. He's falling apart. He's a dead man walking. Man, I relate with that guy right there, because I put on the exterior. When my family and friends said, dude, you did it. You became a Navy SEAL. You're doing this and that. I would put on the exterior. I'd say, oh, yeah, living a dream. Woo, yeah, rock star. But the truth was, I just couldn't put my finger on it. I couldn't explain it. But at the time, I was more miserable than I'd ever been in my entire life. And I thought, if I have anything to look forward to, it's maybe getting a little revenge overseas. And that's not a good fuel to live off of right there. And so that led into some really just dumb things, you know, just drinking and taking it way too far to oblivion, blacking out, and just doing a lot of things that, you know, I'm ashamed of looking back on it. A lot of foolishness. But after hearing this message, it really turned my life around. You know, this name, and he couldn't do anything about his own leprosy. It was just something that somebody couldn't fix themselves of at that time. But he ends up hearing about this man, this prophet, over in Israel, enemy-occupied territory. He's told, if you go over there and visit him, he'll heal you of your leprosy. He makes the 150-mile trip in chariots. He brings his entourage there. They're at the door, knocking on the door. This is the moment. And this guy doesn't even come out to the door. He sends a servant to the door to relay a simple message. If you would just go dip yourself in the Jordan River 7 times, when you come up, your flesh will be restored to you. You'll be clean. Well, I don't know how anyone listening would feel at this moment if they put themselves in Naaman's shoes, but I was right there with them. The Bible says he became furious. Because could you imagine, he just came all this way with his men, and this guy won't even give him the courtesy, the respect, the face-to-face conversation. He sends a servant to the door and then disrespects him by telling him, basically, just go try to wash it off. Like, think he hasn't dove into the river and tried to wash this stuff off yet? And so we don't even have to wonder what's going on inside of his head. He's venting out loud. The Bible says he turned, he began to go away in a rage. And he was saying what he expected, that he expected this guy to come out of his place, to wave his hand over the place, call the name of the Lord his God, strike this leprosy away. In a sense, he was expecting the red carpet treatment. Like, does this guy have any idea who I am? And instead I get treated like a normal and told to go dip myself in the water. He says, I got cleaner waters where I'm from in Damascus. So as he's bailing. He's giving up on it. He's leaving in a rage. And for anyone listening or watching, if you haven't caught it yet, what's his real problem? Like, Naaman had an issue, and it wasn't so much that leprosy. It was his pride.
He had
way too much ego. He wouldn't just humble himself and do what this guy told him to do. Here's the cool thing is that Naaman had some pals. He had some swim buddies. He had some guys that were looking out for him. And they know, like, we can't just let our guy go like that. You know, we want to see him get fixed. And so they go running up to him, and they're pleading with him. They're saying, look, Naaman, come on. You know, if that guy gave you some big, great thing to do, you would have done it. I mean, what if Naaman was told, like, all right, you want to be fixed of your leprosy? Here's what we got for you. You know, we got an obstacle course for you to run. We got a hell week for you to go through. But if you complete these tasks, you know, you will be fixed of your leprosy. I kind of feel like Naaman would be like, show me where to start.
Yeah.
But because it was such a simple thing, to him it seemed like a foolish thing. And what's interesting about that is that's what it says about the preaching of the cross in the New Testament. It says the preaching of the cross is foolishness to those that are perishing. Well, no doubt about it, Naaman here is in a state of perishing, but something his buddies say, it gets through. And so he decides, okay, I'm going to do this thing. And I got to, like, kind of make a point right there. Like, put yourself in his shoes. Like, this is not an easy thing for him to do. He's about to do what I think is by far the most difficult thing for any man to do. He is about to humble himself. Like, that moment where he changes direction and decides, all right, I'm going to go out into that water. That's the moment where a whole lot of other changings of directions are going on, not just with his feet. It's like with his mind, with his heart, with his attitude. He's humbling himself before the Creator. I believe he's really getting it now, that if I'm faithful in doing this thing, it's not that water that's going to fix me. It's that this God of Israel is going to come through and do all the real heavy lifting. So he dips himself those 7 times, and that armor that needed to come off for him to go onto that water, that's what really needed to go, was the pride just coming off, being transparent, dipping himself, coming up that 7th time. When he came up that 7th time, the Bible says he had brand new skin like that of a baby. I remember just kind of being on the edge of my seat listening to this, and it was like, I was relating with Naaman, and this is almost like going to a movie where you're going to watch a movie about a hero. And I used to really like going to the movies, especially at that time. You know, I just cut away because it's just a little break away from reality, from the world. And, you know, movie about a hero like Batman, you know, like, you see this guy, you know, he goes through some adversity, but he always comes out on top, you know, in the end. It all works out. So just like any other movie, like, it all works out for Naaman. And usually by that point in the movie, you know, it all works out for the hero. It's about time for the movie to end. You know, the credits roll, the lights come back on, and now it's back to reality. But, you know, at that time, the way I looked at it is like the credits don't roll right there. It gets pointed out that, look, just as God provided a way out for Naaman, he's provided a way out for you as well. And I was like, you know, what is this? You know, because I was relating with Naaman. That was the jumping off point.
Sure.
You know, but this is where it got real personal. It gets pointed out that just as Naaman was this certain exterior man, it gets questioned, like, who are you? Who are you? When in reality, you got some issues going on underneath it all. So Naaman had this disease that was destroying him. It leads to death. It's leprosy. There's a disease going on underneath it all that every man has. And it's SIN positive. It's sin. It's violating God's law. You know, and so suddenly it's hitting me. Yeah, like, I've been living this life, you know, that would be dishonoring and displeasing to God. you know, I am separated from him because of these things, but there's nothing I could do about the past. Like, it's done. I've got the record. And just like Naaman couldn't do anything about his own leprosy. He's a mess. He's spotted and blotted. He's covered in this. But it gets pointed out, God's provided a way out for you. So just as Naaman had this way out, this is what God did. He sent his son, this is Jesus, to come down into the world. It's like a hostage rescue situation. And he lives a holy, perfect, sinless life. So for not one split second did he ever do anything displeasing or dishonoring to God. And he lives this life that we have not and could not ever live, and he goes to the cross. And the whole purpose of him going to the cross then is explained was to basically trade skin with you and I. So that leprosy in the Old Testament being like a picture of sin, being spotted and blotted, just a mess, that's our life spiritually speaking apart from God. We're spotted and blotted, we're a mess. But Jesus was holy, pure, unblemished. He goes to the cross and he trades skin with you and I. Takes all of our leprosy, our sin upon himself, dies in our place like a hero. That's where you get the line that is on so many t-shirts and so many walls and different, you know, places in the military. Greater love has no one than this one that lays on his life for his friends. So he lays on his life, you know, for you and I, for everyone, pays the penalty that I deserve to pay in full. And then the critical thing here that a lot of people don't know about the story is he rises again from the dead. And the significance behind that is that it shows he has power not only over sin at the cross, he has power, you know, over the grave. Not even the grave can hold him down. So rising again from the dead, and then he declares, because I live, you also shall live. And what he's talking about is not just this temporal life, the resurrected life. That as he overcame the grave, you can have this life that overcomes the grave. Like, death is not the end. Like, your last breath here on earth can be your first breath, you know, in heaven, in eternity. And so hearing this message, something about it, it just really struck me to the core.
And when was this? When what year was this? Where were you in your Navy career when you had this?
This was March 14th, 2007. I was a SEAL by December of 2015. So, yeah, it was about a year and a half or so into it. And I just realized, like, I need to respond to this. And I found myself doing what I was told I needed to do. Just forsake, just turn from all of these sinful things, you know, any type of lies I've ever told in my life, looking with lust at women. Jesus says that's adultery, you know, anything I've ever, you know, stolen in the past, even if it was something small, like, these are all violating God's law. If you violate the law, you deserve to pay, you know, punishment. Jesus paid it at the full. And so I just found myself just, I want this new life. I want this clean slate. So I turned from sin. And I put my faith and trust in Jesus to be my savior. That's why he's called the savior. What's he saved me from? He's saving me from the nasty consequences that will come with that sin. And so the moment any man or woman does that, you know, as explained to me, like, God will remove their sin, just as Naaman was wiped clean, brand new skin. The New Testament says, repent, be converted, that your sins may be blotted out, that times refreshing may come. And so March 14, 2007, that's exactly what I did. And man, I experienced what the scriptures say. If any man be in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things pass away, and behold, all things become new. I really felt like this new man, forgiven of sin. I got a right relationship with my creator. And the way I look at it now is, now I could really be satisfied, you know, being a Navy SEAL, because now, you know, it's for so much more, not just this temporal life, but for eternal life. Like, the things that we do echo eternity. And so, you know, fast forward to the final operation I was on and finally having that opportunity to be out there, you know, in the Middle East, I no longer had that chip on my shoulder, you know, where I kind of had this mentality, like, I hate these people, you know, before Christ. But now, you know, I just realized, like, we're in a fallen world, man. It's a mess, you know, and sin is a toxic thing. And I think there's so much more than just, like, this physical reality. There's a spiritual reality. I really find, you know, I'll just say it, like, I find it to be satanic. I think it's demonic what's going on in the Middle East. I mean, just look at what they do. It's like, to this day, like, ISIS burying families,
insane.
Children alive, yeah. Burning the Jordanian pilot, you know, and that's like, what kind of a person does that, you know? And so it's just sick. And so some of the stuff needs to be dealt with the sword, you know? And God says in Romans chapter 13 that the government does not bear the sword in vain. We're to be a terror in the lives of those that commit terror. Yes. And so that's exactly what we're doing. as SEALs. And so we're working with a group called the ISOF, Iraqi Special Operations Forces. It was another one of those advise and assist type of operations, but we could actually, you know, take the fight to the front with them. And we're particularly trying to hunt down guys that were making suicide vests and roadside bombs, and everything went pretty good. I'd smooth on that deployment. No one from our team had gotten hurt. We've bagged and gagged some bad dudes, making the world a better place. And I remember coming up on what looked like we just had just enough time on the calendar before we leave to do one more operation. And so we weren't really sure if the ISOF was ready for us to pass the baton to them and take off. And so we decided for this final op, why don't we make it a sort of graduation operation? We'll let them plan the whole thing from the ground up, and we'll be there with them just in case things hit the fan. So they start from scratch. They need, you know, some intel. They're hitting the streets trying to find some source. And, you know, they get some info about a guy that's an Iraqi policeman. So this guy, they present it to us, is an Iraqi policeman. But, you know, at night back home, he's one of these bomb makers that we're looking for. So we kind of double check it through our sources. And, all right, it all checks out. Legit. And so they ask us for this final op. Hey, we're wondering if you guys would be willing to maybe take off your American-colored uniforms. And we've got some ISOF uniforms for you guys to put on so you could blend in with us. They kind of felt like they were being, you know, singled out, that, you know, Navy SEALs, whenever they operate with them, they stood out because, you know, they're rolling in the big RG-33 vehicles. They got the different feet. Like, so they felt they get shot at, you know, and SEALs don't. So they're saying, would you be willing to put on these uniforms, go back to the Humvees, literally strip the paint off your Humvee, paint them our colors? And we're like, all right, do all this so that we blend in with you so that we could potentially get shot at more with you. And they're like, yeah, it's like, fine. It's the last operation, like whatever, you know, we'll do this. You know, we have no fear. And so, you know, we paint up the vehicles to be their colors. We put on their uniforms. And, you know, the irony is that, you know, here I am over there, you know, my dark complexion for anyone watching, got a little facial hair. Then I get on an Iraqi uniform. I put that thing on. I'm looking around. I'm like, I really blend in with these guys around here now. And so, you know, for this final operation, I was in the turret, the Humvee, behind that 50 caliber machine gun, and got my weapon, headspace, and time ready to go. Night vision goggles on, looking through that green little world. And, you know, we're about to roll out. And I couldn't help but think, like, this is the last operation, which also means I know just a matter of days from now, I'm going to be back home, Huntington Beach, California, surfing in the ocean. And so we're rolling out. And I remember passing a sign on the way that we'd passed before, but it never stuck out to me the way that it stuck out to me on this last operation. And it was a sign, Fallujah, Iraq, in Arabic. It's one of those last big signs you see before you turn into Fallujah. So what hit me was, I wonder if Scott, his eyes, looked at that same exact sign, you know, before he went in to Fallujah down that road. It hadn't been that many years since then, so, you know, there's a good chance, just a handful of years. And I just kind of tripped out on that. And I thought about how little did he know, like, what was about to happen. He didn't know he's being set up at that time on that ambush. Well, the crazy thing is that I'm thinking about that. Little does my team know, we're being set up right now on an ambush. And so we pull up to the place where we're going to get this guy. And it's sort of that moment where you're entering into your most vulnerable position. There's always that moment where you got to go from an armored vehicle and go through some open dead space, you know, through a courtyard. And so just as we're entering into that moment, doors are opening. Some of the guys have already gotten out. That's where just everything, all hell breaks loose. We're getting shot at from three different directions, taking what we'd call effective fire, the call over the radio, tick, 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 troops in combat. And so, you know, we're in a gunfight and it's an ambush. The odds are very much against you in an ambush. I mean, just look what happened with my mentor. You know, all the guys he was with in that vehicle got completely, you know, wiped out. You know, but the difference maker here, I think, was the resources we had available to us. Scott, at the time, you know, they had soft skin vehicles. They had armored vehicles. They didn't have 50 caliber machine guns. They were just given a little M4s. They didn't have the communication system. They didn't have the mapping that we had. So we had a luxury. You know, we had the armory. We had those resources behind us. And it's just time for us to do what SEALs do best. And, you know, this is a good little teaching moment right here. Part of the SEAL creed, it says, you know, the ability to control your emotions and actions regardless of the circumstances. And I mean, circumstances don't get any worse than this type of ambush. And that's for every man out there. You ought to have the ability to control your emotions and actions regardless of the circumstances. There's going to be situations where your family gets hit sideways. maybe you get ambushed in some way. And for the men out there, they're all going to be looking to dad, the leader. How should we respond? Because the way that the leader responds is going to be contagious. It's going to affect those that are around him. So I remember my assault leader coming over the radio. So first it's tick, 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 troops in combat. And the first things he says over the radio really set the tone. He says, all right, boys, we're getting out of here live, but I need you to push left. And so push left, tactically speaking, basically meant that we're not hightailing it out of here. We're going to maneuver on these guys. We're going to flank these guys right now. But to hear the way, the confidence and the calmness and coolness that he said that, man, that just, it gave me and I believe everybody there like that confidence, that coolness so that we could think clearly and do what we do best, shoot, move, and communicate. It could have gone differently. If he came over the radio in panic, under attack, every man for himself, you know, like that would create total hysteria, you know, total pandemonium. But instead, he had that calmness and coolness. And so now we're doing what we do best, shoot, move, communicate. We wind up killing, driving back the enemy. And then we decide just to push through all the way. Let's get this guy. So we got the guy that we're going after. He was wounded and alive. And I remember having the responsibility. I was one of the guys that had to carry this man in our own hospital. And this was like a real full circle closure thing for me. Because years ago, I do not know what I would have done, like put in that situation right there, you know, but now here I am, like I'm operating on the principles of a SEAL, like in the SEAL teams, it's preserve life wherever possible, you know, but also just that totally correlates with, you know, what I am as a Christian man as well. But it was really put to the test right there because we're operating in a region, in a province where, you know, we're near where my mentor, you know, Scott was ambushed. And for all I know, you know, here's one of the guys that could have been there that day, or just one of the guys that obviously was in agreement with what happened, wounded and alive. And here we are carrying him into our own hospital. And I remember just being kind of face to face with this guy, just being so close, like intimately, like close carrying somebody. And he's moaning and groaning, you know, because he was shot and, you know, he had the headband on so he couldn't see, but you see the scruff on the face. And I remember just thinking, like, this is crazy. You were just trying to kill us. And, you know, and now we're saving your life. And for me, it was just a real full circle. Just like I wanted to get the guy off my hands. So once we took him to the hospital, it's like, I'm glad I made it through that, you know, right there, past that test. But that was a real full circle moment for me.
Man, right there. That's a great story. And I mean, everything that you've started talking with, it's obvious you are a great speaker and great storyteller. And I know you do that now as a profession. But, you know, your journey, it sounds like your journey is not unlike many other people's journey that, you know, that want a similar profession in their life where it's a bunch of forks in the road, mm-hmm. right? You had that fork in the road in that parking lot, right? Yeah. And you swerved hard. You swerved hard. I'm going down this road. You had that fork in the road when you're working out with Scott Helveston.
Right? That's right.
You could have slowed down. You could have stopped, could have turned back around, you know, but you kept pushing, right? And you had that fork in the road when you're going through Buds. You had that fork in the road when you, you know, signed the dotted line and you get into the teams. And you had this fork in the road of when you made that decision to, you know, go more with religion and be a more religious figure and have it be a part of your life. And that's, you know, we all have those journeys. And, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of just taking the right fork in the road, right? Going the right direction, right? And it's not an impossible journey. It's not a journey where you obviously know good and bad decisions, right? You know these decisions. And one thing I think where you made a comment in, like people are just never satisfied and you're just always hungry for the next thing is that, you know, many of us live in the past, you know, and we have severe issues with dealing with the past and we're never really in the present. You know, many of us are living in the future saying, you know, this next thing is going to make me happy. This next thing is going to make me fulfilled, you know, whereas we just need to learn how to live in the present. Right. That's right. One of my favorite songs is by the Eagles and it's called Learn to Be Still. Right. It is just one of those little songs that just makes you sit back and realize you're blessed. and to be content. But, I mean, we all still have dreams. I am sure, even though you are blessed and content with your present situation, you still have dreams and goals. Not that these goals are going to be, you know, super life-changing and you can stop, you know, but as humans, we don't really want to stop. We want to keep moving, right? And keep moving in the right direction. That's the key, moving in the right direction. So where is your next direction taking you?
So my next direction, if people haven't picked up on it yet, I'm very passionate about sharing the message of the gospel, which is the story of Jesus, the life that he lived here on earth, what he did for us at the cross, rising again from the dead. You know, because the way that I see it is that just as a Navy SEAL, I can make a difference as a Navy SEAL, you know, on the battlefield for earthly freedom. But what Jesus did at the cross, he made a difference, not just for earthly freedom. He made a difference for eternal freedom. And so I just saw that as so much more significant. You know, I realized that at first I wanted to be a career SEAL, you know, but once I had that relationship with the Lord, I realized like the next time that comes up to reenlist, I think that I'm going to be getting out and I want to get involved in spreading this message. You know, I want to go all over the place and share it with everybody. And that's what I was doing right from the start, almost in a reckless way. You know, yeah. I was one of those crazy, like Jesus freaks that was like a boy in a china shop, just trying to convert everybody, like in my platoon, in my family, like just going around everywhere. Definitely have learned, you know, along the way, I think like a smoother way to go about it. But that's sure. Just sort of stumbling along the way.
Well, your story is very honest, you know, and it's very, it's unique too. I mean, you're coming at it from a warrior's point of view. And sometimes, you know, not sometimes, all the time, you know, when I see warriors that are doing well with what they have done in the past, is that they have some kind of spiritual foundation and that they can justify that they are the good guy. I mean, you have to be able to justify that you are the good guy when you do some of the things that, you know, that, and see some of the things that tactical professionals have to do and see.
Yeah. As I think about it, you kind of got me thinking in a way, it's like when I didn't have a right relationship with God, when I didn't have that foundation, I couldn't at that point in my life after becoming Navy SEAL, after achieving that, I couldn't die happy. I couldn't die. I wouldn't be content. But once I had that right relationship, you know, with God, I could say at any point now, like I could die happy. Of course, I'd be so bummed to like be separated from my wife and from my children, but I could die happy. Like I could be, you know, content, you know, with that. And so that sort of gives you this bulletproof mindset then, you know, moving forward. Like overseas, I knew like in Iraq, like I'm right with my God. And so if you took my life, if one of these rounds catches me, you know, right through the face, you know, that last breath there is my first breath in heaven. You could destroy this body, but you can't do anything to my soul. You know, I'm bulletproof. And so it's that what you're talking about there. It's that you have the peace with your creator. You got that bulletproof mindset. You have that peace moving forward, knowing you are the good guy. You're doing the good thing. I like that. Right.
That's cool. Well, let's share a little bit about what you are doing to help spread the word a little bit. I know you have this product here.
That's right.
God book. It's on Amazon. You guys can find it on Amazon there. And you wrote that thing several years ago.
Yeah. And it recently surpassed over 100,000 copies in print. Actually got a cool thing from the publisher sent to me where they sent me a hard copy. And so now all the printings, it says that right at the top, you know, over 100,000 copies. And the foreword by Greg Laurie, he's the man that was speaking the night that he shared that message about Naaman.
Yes. So
it's pretty cool to get the foreword there from him. But yeah, now I'm just doing a lot of, every year it's progressed. And so when I got out, I immediately got involved in ministry as a part of a ministry called Living Waters with this guy, Ray Comfort. He had partnered up with Kirk Cameron from Growing Pains. So Kirk is, you know, one of those movie stars that is a believer. And I was on board with that ministry and just, we were training people, teaching them how to share their faith individually and collectively with a group of people. Eventually, I got on staff with my church that I was going to, that Greg Laurie is the pastor of. And I slowly began to get these opportunities to speak and to share with other people. And Ray Comfort, that the head of Living Waters, he had really encouraged me to write a book. And at the time I thought, oh man, you know, like when you're in, like I remember times just sitting around at the platoon, like guys would just be bagging on guys like, hey, did you hear about so-and-so? He got out and wrote a book. It's like not like, when guys are in, that is not the thing to do. But the funny thing is, it's like, you know, the guys that like sometimes bark the loudest about, I can't believe that guy wrote a book. Like you find out that guy got out and wrote a book, you know? And so, you know, the way it was presented to me was like, look, you could do a lot of good with this. You know, it's not a brag session. You be open, you be honest with people. And this is also an opportunity for you to share your faith, to share the gospel. So that's why the book is called Seal of God, which is so strange. Like a lot of people, like some of the negative reviews that I get sometimes, it's got good reviews overall, but some of the negative reviews, like sometimes people put like, wow, this really took a turn I wasn't expecting, you know, as he got all religious on us. It's like, the book's called
Seal of God. How could you not understand that?
Yeah.
It's right in the title.
It doesn't start off religious, you know, it's all chronological.
Yeah.
So anyways, I got the book done and that started opening up opportunities for me to speak. It was like, as that spread kind of across the nation, it was like little seeds in the minds of, you know, pastors and leaders to, hey, let's get this guy out here. So every year progressively, like I picked up more and more and more speaking to one. It was like 20 events this year, 30 events that year, 40 events. I think I did like 70 events last year.
That's professional.
It crossed over a little bit too into the corporate realm. So I wasn't doing that at first. But it's crossed over. I'd say about a third of the speaking that I do is for corporations. I don't come across with the faith stuff so strong there. You know, I realize that I'm being invited out to share about other things.
Sure.
So I just talk about, you know, mental toughness, you know, dealing with adversity, just a lot of the principles that we learned, that it's all right there, like in the SEAL Creed. Forged by adversity, common man with uncommon desire to succeed, you know, in the worst conditions, relying upon the legacy of those who have gone before. It's like, there's so much great stuff there that, you know, it applies on the battlefield. And it certainly, if it works on the battlefield in life and death situations, it applies into the, whatever sphere, you know, these corporations are involved in. And so that's just one of those things that, you know, I love to share as well, you know, on leadership, the SEAL teams in the military, we got it right. It's servant leadership, you know, it's that top guy, that assault leader, really investing into those that are around him. Scott was the ultimate example of a servant leader. I mean, he really took me under his wing. He treated me like a son. And so when you invest into people like that around you, what it does is you get something out of them that money cannot buy. You know, it's loyalty. So that when you give them a task, they don't just do it begrudgingly. Like, they do it because they want to make you proud. You know, and so everyone kind of has that choice to be a servant leader or, you know, we've all been around somebody like this, the opposite of a servant leader, prideful, arrogant person that nobody likes to work for. Sure, you're the boss. Yeah, people got to listen to you because you're the boss, but nobody does it happily. And the sad thing is that a leader like that, everything will backfire on them because maybe one day they capture a great vision or direction for their company to go in. But guess what? You need some good sled dogs to see this thing through. Yeah. And if you got people that aren't really willing to give you 100%, then that vision of yours will never soar quite as high as it could have. It'll be like an eagle with its wings clipped.
Yeah.
And so in the SEAL teams, as you know, it's always the team first. The team first, then my buddy, then me. You know, that's our practice. I don't got to look over my own back as I go through a door because I know my buddy's got my back and he doesn't have to look over his back. I got his back. It's that family dynamic. That's what servant leadership is. And so that's like some of the stuff that I like to get into.
Oh, I love it. That's great.
Corporate
that's
great groups. Stuff. Yeah.
So I guess the journey for you continues. And you live out in California.
Yep.
So what's what would you say the next 5 years will be for Chad Williams?
I think continue doing what I'm doing now, this the speaking and just to a greater capacity. So every year it's grown and grown. And so as of right now, I've got 18 events already on the calendar lined up and we're just in January right now.
Okay. And
so more stuff is filling in.
All right. What about maybe getting more involved with the church? Are you thinking about maybe even having your own church one day?
Yeah. You know what? That's the very like long-term. I think that's sort of my slowdown because I don't want to be this traveling man forever.
Yeah.
I know that the iron is hot. And so I should take this opportunity while it's right here in front of me. you know, my children are an age right now where it's I'm not so noticed, you know, when I'm gone, and I try and make a quick turnaround. So if I'm speaking somewhere on you know, a Saturday morning, I'll fly out on the last flight, like Friday night.
Same.
And I'll get there maybe with just a handful of hours. You know, you're not going to get much sleep, you know, in the hotel. I'll go speak that Saturday morning and I'll get that first flight going back. Yeah. And so it's a little rough traveling like that a lot, but it's low impact on the family. Because as far as my family's concerned, well, Daddy was here with us all the way up until Friday night and he's back, you know, Saturday evening. And so I try and make that back and forth. But I don't always want to be this guy that is traveling away. So I think that I do want to set some roots and begin to pastor a local church off in the distant future. But this is something that I'm definitely hitting as hard as I can just right now. Just this itinerant, you know,
absolutely,
speaking and traveling. But
any other writing ventures in the future?
I got a couple of different things that I'm working on the faith-based side and then like on the non-faith side as well. You know, one of them I think is just, you know, how to be a man in today's culture where, you know, just they're just stripping, you know, masculinity and what that is in society today. And so from a biblical perspective, you know, what that is to be a mighty man of valor, to be, you know, because nowadays they make dad out to be the fool, you know, in the family. It's like all in the sitcoms, you know, the dad's a stumbling fool and, you know, it's a bad thing to be, you know, masculine and. It's just a lot of confusion and just toxic thoughts going on out there. So I am a little passionate and driven to be writing on that. So I've just been putting some things together there.
Right. Now this website here is sealofchrist.com, and that's where people can find more about you, maybe get some speaking engagements with you if somebody wants to have you over there speaking with them. Is that where they contact you?
Yeah, there's a couple different locations. So that's the faith side, sealofchrist.com. Yeah. And then I also have a non-faith site. It would be Navy Seal Chad Williams.com. And that's like where a corporate group could book me. And, you know, there's the book too. So if someone wanted a signed copy of the book, they could click on that right there to get a signed copy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
But I've been on some different groups there, Fox News and CNN, a handful of times, and I've had some pretty cool opportunities. Yeah, they fill out that info right there if they wanted to book me. So anyone listening that can't see right now, we're just kind of looking at the website.
We're sharing it with everybody, so it's part of the whole system here. So
that's a Carl Gustav. That's the perfect moment of where the backblast, you could see it as that rocket's going out. At a place I'm sure you're familiar with, Nyland.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome. That's really cool. Well, Chad, I do appreciate you helping me with my project here. I call it the To, Through, and After project. And I'm getting a whole lot of you guys. You know, we got SEALs, some SF guys, some other tactical professionals in the fire departments, and, you know, just their whole story of service. And, you know, I really enjoyed listening to you share your journey, and hopefully we got some young ears that, you know, understand that process of where they are at 18, 19 years old and realize that, you know, sometimes, it, you know, call to serve is not that, not that difficult, but it's not that hard of a decision to make. Now, the process of preparing can be very difficult and it requires a lot of effort. And I tell people all the time, I never want to motivate somebody to serve their country. You know, that's not my job.
Right.
You know what I mean? I want you to come to me motivated to serve your country and then we'll go from there.
How many times do you get asked that question, you know, through social media? Like, hey, I don't know what I want to do with my life. Tell me, what should I do?
Yeah,
it's like, dude, you got to know what you want to do. Yeah. You know, that's for you. That's very personal. You got to figure that out right there and kind of point you some directions.
Right.
You know, but yeah, just they got to capture that vision for themselves. And then, you know, a guy like you is that the resource then once they have that target in mind, you know, once they have their aim, you know, you can really teach them how to sharpen up that aim.
Well, I think we all can. You know, I think that's the one of the great things about social media and YouTube and, you know, websites and books is that, you know, it does give people a great education and an insight maybe they now grasp that they didn't have before. And I think
right. Only this is nuts to me. I'm talking to Stu Smith. I had that guide in the background there, you know, Navy SEAL Fitness. I never thought, you know, that I'd be talking on video to Stu Smith.
Well, and cool. Thank you.
Crazy the impact that you've had on me. I know for a fact two guys that are over there at Buds right now about to phase up that I did some work with. I pointed them in the direction of your guide as well. It's invaluable. It's just insane how, you know, influential. I don't even know if you could really know just the full impact that you've had on so many guys that have gone through, that are in currently right now. You're doing a whole lot of good.
Well, thank you. I that was my initial goal, by all means, was to just help, you know, with the journey. Because I remember going to Buds, and I remember seeing, you know, and it hasn't really changed that much. You know, you go there and you got 150 people that start off with you on day one, and you can't even learn everybody's name in your own boat crew.
Yeah.
Because it changes three or four times.
That's right.
In the first 2 weeks, you know, and then, you know, by Hell Week, you've dropped down to 30 people.
Yeah.
You know? And, right. You know, those are the guys that are going to stick around. Right. Yeah. And it's tough, you know, and I remember seeing, I said, man, we could probably do a lot better with preparation. And now it's cool that the Navy actually has, you know, the preparation, you know, the Buds Prep instead. So their A school for the SO is to go to Buds Prep. Right. Yeah. And then they go to Buds, and, you know, what a great idea that was. Genius, you know, and, you know, hopefully it's preparing more people. I think Buds has probably gotten harder, to be honest with you, since my time, you know, because it is nothing but combat veterans that are now the instructors.
Yeah.
You know, when I was in, we had a few Vietnam vets that were still around, you know, in the early 90s, and it was still hard, you know, still had you know, 80% attrition rate, but, you know, it's, the journey is real. And like I said, I tell people all the time, you know, self-motivation goes a long way. Having your whys figured out, you know, and, you know, and some ego goes a long way too at the beginning. I mean, you have to be bold. You have to be bold to say, hell yeah, I'm going to go do this.
Right.
You know, like young Chad Williams. And, you know, and you had a great mentor there that brought you along the way. But you know what? He didn't have to motivate you.
Right.
You know what I mean? That first workout you did with Scott Helvenston may have reaffirmed your motivation, but he didn't motivate you. You know, you were going to die before you quit. You know, that's who makes it through these programs. Like that's
exactly it right there.
Yeah, man. So thank you so much. I think your story is wonderful. It's I'm glad you are sharing it with the world, because I think the world needs it.
Thank you.
Just thank you for being on my show two through and after. And hopefully I can get more guys like you to come aboard and do another story with me, because this is great. You know, it's going to motivate me all weekend. So
awesome. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for spending some time with me, and super honored to just be on the program with you.
All right. Hey, thank you very much. And everybody, tune in next time for the next two through and after.